Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read, welcoming you to a really unique presentation by Fresno writer Sally Stallings. She tells us all about what it was like to see her own daughter, who at the time was a precocious 8-year-old, dance in an all-time favorite, Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Ballet. And it all happened right here at Fresno's Saroyan Theater. Here she is to read two short stories for us, The Yellow Dressing Room and Backstage.
The Yellow Dressing Room, dedicated to my daughter, Sarah Lauren Griglione. High on her crown, her top knot of silky brown hair was encircled by a wide blue satin bow and drawn away from her delicate oval face. The sheen of satin competed with her glistening, sun-streaked, collar-length hair and the radiance of her large brown eyes. Her blue ribbon matched her satin knee-length dress, layered with a white lace apron. Crinoline petticoats and white tights encased her slender legs. New black ballet shoes adorned her high-arched, narrow feet. Sarah, 8 years old, possessed all the loveliness of a crystal day, with vibrant blue skies, whiter than white cumulus clouds, and everything beautiful and pure. In just 45 minutes, our daughter would be performing in the Nutcracker Suite at William Saroyan Theater. She was one of the 8 young dancers who would enter from stage left, concealed beneath the huge gold-ruffled hoop skirt of the giant 6-foot bonneted Bo Peep character. On cue, the big woman would raise her skirts, releasing the young ballerinas to scamper, dance, and twirl as they approached the stage apron footlights. The cafeteria-sized yellow dressing room with overhead UV lighting pulsed as though from nervous excitement. Chattering, gasping, and squealings were heard throughout the hall. Thumps, thuds, clumps, and scuffles from ballet shoes resonated on the light oak floor. Parts of Tchaikovsky's masterpiece could be heard through open dressing room doors, along with final commands by the wiry, skull-faced, black-haired ballet mistress. Occupying the center of the spacious dressing room, teenage ballerinas rehearsed one last time difficult movements on point, while the younger dancers, including my daughter, sat on the lacquered floor in blue satin clusters, looking like frosted cupcakes at a tea party. While putting black ballet shoes on their small wriggling feet, hair-sprayed young heads huddled together and whispered. They stared, mesmerized by their older heroines, executing tricky choreography, nearly pirouetting on top of them. Lining the perimeter of the hall were ballet banisters, positioned in front of full-length mirrors, extending 12 feet toward the ceiling. Chipped dressing tables were strewn with open bottles of makeup, exposed lipstick tubes, uncapped cans of hairspray, bobby pins, brushes, hair clips, ribbons of all colors, and cotton balls. Scrunched up paper bags smeared with ketchup from takeout food and wax cups with nervously bitten bent straws were discarded into cardboard bins placed by the dressing room door. Rolling wooden chairs and screeching metal stools were scooted and shoved helter-skelter across the polished floor from one dressing table to another to check a friend's makeup, hairdo, or to straighten a friend's stocking. Tangled masses of pink and purple tutus, looking like wads of bubble gum and cones of cotton candy, were slung onto wire hangers crushed together on metal wardrobe racks along one wall of the spacious room. Ballerinas of every age were struggling into elastic, form-fitting tights, brushing their hair and hastily crisscrossing silver laces partway up well-toned calves. Studying their image in wall mirrors, lithe ballerinas scrutinize their body line while freezing a pose in space, arching their backs with extended arms like graceful birds frozen in flight. Zippers needed to be zipped, buttons needed to be buttoned, and final makeup yet to be applied. Mothers, including myself, had brought in McDonald's for their daughters, many of whom were too excited to finish their junior cheeseburgers, yet managed to stuff down the French fries and slurp their root beer. "Just one more bite, sweetie. Come on, come on. You will need the energy on stage. We only have one half an hour before the show starts." Seated at the dressing table, with her last bite barely swallowed, I reapplied the final coat of poppy red lipstick on Sarah's full-lipped, small-chewing mouth, taking care not to plaster crumbs into the upturned corners. Her dark-lashed brown eyes reflected the mirror makeup lights as I lined dark eyeliner to their expressive shapes. Studying her porcelain face in my cupped hands, I saw a vision of the beautiful woman she would become and the tender, lovely child she is now. The curvilinear, full-rounded line of her forehead, down her upturned nose, continuing around and under her modest chin, reminded me of the children's faces painted by Renoir. Her spirit was as tender and true as spring rain in sunshine. Part 2. Backstage. We had 20 minutes before the Nutcracker suite would begin. Backstage, with every turn of my head, I saw a photograph to be translated into a potential painting. My visual memory kept replaying the works of Edgar Degas and the way his brush and pastel sticks captured the realism of the Parisian ballet salons of the late 1800s. He depicted each of his teen and preteen ballerinas as wiry, angular, and exhausted to the state of nausea. Their strained, tired, youthful faces and sinewy athletic bodies were rendered on canvas with thick oil impasto, or with broad pastel strokes. Degas' expressive ballerina sculptures were characterized by Careless Scraggly Ponytails, the backs of bodices loosened, and their young frames slouched in repose. Everything about them, everything, revealed hardcore, strenuous discipline. There was nothing rounded, soft, or romantic about Degas' bronze figures, but rather they were tough, muscular, and stringy like wild gangly game hens. Even the metal castings seemed to sweat from long hours of practice. With the director's permission, I remained in the wings to be near my daughter and to photograph, being careful to omit the flash. From my vantage point, I could hear the muffled anticipation and shufflings of the arriving audience. Warming up, the orchestra's violin section drew their bows across strings over a hollow wood, sounding like fingernails scraping a chalkboard. Aware of the hushing, shushes, and whispers around me, I stood with pounding heart, looking through my Minolta viewfinder. Camera securely in hand, with its leather strap chafing my lace-collared neckline, I photographed in the dark sea of the backstage, surrounded by the now silent dancers. Heavy black velvet curtains extended upwards, reaching metal rafters and catwalks, mounted with rows of 2,000-watt stage lights. Roped pulleys, 2 inches thick, operated the massive drapes on either side of where I stood facing stage. I could feel the extra slack of bristly curtain cable carelessly coiled on the floor beneath my socked feet, like the curling tendrils of a sea creature. Curtain going up! Through my lens, obscured in the dim light behind the tonnage of hanging velvet, I studied the now charcoal contours of the ballerinas in long straight postures in this dark gray ocean. Several stood with their arms folded across their white satin bellies or in third position with their hands placed on netted hips. I captured 10 frames of the silhouetted 9-year-old girls and lovely Sarah, crouching on the scuffed floor, leaning small shoulders into another's, resembling Rorschach ink blots. A pencil-thin white line of rim light, cast from the now brightly lit stage, outlined their sweet child profiles. All were listening intently, waiting their turn. Using a 200-millimeter close-up lens open to an f-stop 5.6, I snapped abstract angles of dancers' feet and hands, tying their slipper laces or scuffing their ballet shoes on blocks of rosin before their stage entrance. Using a fast 400-speed slide film, I photographed back views in every graceful stance imaginable. Defined alabaster vertebrae and shoulder blades were more pronounced in the shadowed alcove. Degas' spirit remained with me as the ballet continued. And on film, short, stiff, triangular tutus were transparent yellow as they transitioned from stage wings to stage footlights. Silver toe shoes and all the sparkly sprinkles on net reflected a zillion pinpoints of light. In the dark, black clothed stagehands scurried like crouching rats, stealthily positioning round metal washtubs of dry ice in the wings. Waves of bluish-white fog wafted across the stage, transformed by blue and green colored gels through which the sugar plum fairy danced. Pirouetting ballerinas, costumed in white, glowed phosphorus, while rhinestone hair ornaments, fastened into circular buns, reflected overhead lights like swirling stars in a cosmic Van Gogh sky. I photographed everything, everywhere and everyone. 6 rolls of film recorded long-distance shots as well as soft focus close-ups. Realizing the nutcracker was coming to a close, I hammered the shutter repeatedly to ensure the capture of the back view of one particular ballerina in a second position stance awaiting her cue. With the subtle tilt of her head and torso, this angular teenager was destined to become my subject for an oil painting. With Degas' help, my personal ghost in the shadows, I had found what I was seeking. I tacked my photo to the top of my easel. Priming a 30 by 40 inch canvas in chalky white gesso and underpainting its surface in burnt sienna, I struggled for 3 days with the fluid brush drawing of the ballerina back view. The gesture of her head and upper torso was just right, but the legs were impossible. Well, the knees were too bulky. Wipe it off, try again. Looking like a disconnected marionette, the backs of the thighs didn't feel connected to the buttocks. Wipe it off, do it again. Her rigid 10-layer tutu in no way conformed to her backside. Well, I couldn't find the gluteus maximus as I drew. Wipe it off, try again. Where was my definition of the calves? Those I portrayed resembled the legs of a 400-pound heavyweight. The contours were tricky in that I didn't have enough detail in the dark areas of the photograph from which to copy. Her slippered feet, drawn too huge and flat-footed, looked as though they belonged to Bozo, the ballerina clown. These lower body drawing difficulties were because of both camera distortion and my lack of skill. More frustrated than I had ever been, having spent late night hours at my rickety wooden easel and getting little sleep, surrounded by smelly brown stained rags on the concrete floor by my paint-spattered shoes, I sat on my battered workbench, quiet and forlorn. My husband, Steve, wearing blue-striped pajama shorts and a white T-shirt, refilled my coffee cup, sat down beside me, and listened while I explained my despair. With his back toward me, crossing my studio, he compared my large, incomplete canvas to my photo. Interestingly, Steve's feet assumed a sort of third positional stance as he studied my painting. He was standing in front and to the right of the canvas, while the partially drawn dancer was on the left. Positioned side by side, I couldn't help but to scrutinize both figures. No! Am I seeing what I'm seeing? Unbelievable! Their legs and knees were almost the same size with the same conformation. Steve's legs were wiry. Her legs were wiry. His ankles were slender and well-defined. Her ankles were slender and well-defined. She had my husband's exact legs. She had man legs, pure muscle, no fat, and no jelly. "Freeze! Hold it! Wait! I'll be right back," I yelled. "You are it! I've got it!" Returning with a pink lace nightgown, I tucked, fluffed, and stuffed the fabric around and under his elastic waistband, creating a rolled type of tutu. That's when our hysteria began. His midsection resembled a pink donut, and his legs had the appearance of the black, hairy legs of Jeff Goldblum, who starred in the movie The Fly. With my demonstration, Steve practiced his ballet second position until it was perfect. Both of us vibrating from uncontrollable laughter, his tutu quivering, my brush wobbling, he positioned one bare foot, sort of perpendicular to the other, enabling me to capture the back view of Ballerina Man. I wonder what Degas would have to say about this. Looking at this painting 30 years later, I see and hear all the enchantment of that exhilarating evening, having been such a part of behind the scenes. The graceful ballerina in the wings, the subject of my completed painting, resulted in my husband's first and only ballet lesson. Why didn't I photograph him? Postscript. In June 2008, our 6-year-old granddaughter, Jessica, performed her first ballet recital on the stage of the Soroyan Theater. This time, it was our daughter's turn backstage to costume Jessica in sparkles and excitedly focus her camera. From my red cushioned seat in the audience, I could envision our daughter behind similar velvet drapes, cupping Jessica's tender face in her hands and seeing her little child as a woman. As for me, I sat in the audience, front row center, beside Ballerina Man, my arm through his. Lost in the memory of Sarah in blue satin, performing on stage so long ago, I watched our granddaughter, like the tiny figure on the top of a music box, twirl under spotlights. And for a moment, just a fleeting crossover moment, I saw both little girls on stage together.
That was Sally Stallings reading two of her short stories, The Yellow Dressing Room and Backstage. The stories are two of the author's unforgettable memories. She's also a fine painter, watching, supporting, and taking photos of her daughter warming up to dance in Tchaikovsky's famous Nutcracker Ballet at Fresno's own Soroyan Theater. One time, she took a photo of one of the dancers, decided to use it as a model for a painting, But while she was able to paint the top half of the dancer, she seemed totally stumped when it came to painting the dancer's body from the waist down. Luckily, her husband helped her by modeling for her, in as much as his legs seemed to be about the same shape as that of the dancer. And guess what? 30 years later, the author's 6-year-old granddaughter, Jessica, performed in the very same ballet on that very same stage. This time, her grandparents were out there in the audience, looking on with pride and satisfaction. Folks, Sally Stallings, who is an art major at Cal Poly, is currently a member of Janice Stevens' writing group. She wrote 2 stories that were published in Stories of Service, compiled by that writing group. A very interesting fact about Sally Stallings is that her father, Lawrence Stallings, was a renowned author, playwright, and screenwriter who was most known for 2 outstanding films, What Price Glory and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Thank you for your fine stories tonight, Sally Stallings. Feel free to send us more of your work in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you would like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Steve Yarborough. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.